I'd like to look with you this morning at that event described here in Mark's Gospel, but also spoken of by all the other Gospel writers, commonly called the Transfiguration of Jesus. What is the miracle here? That's what I'd like you to think about, and I'll be talking about that a little bit later. And even with just a very superficial reading of this account, it's obvious that there is much here which is majestic, and there's much here which is challenging to our minds and understanding. I'm conscious that the water here is very deep, that the ground here is holy, that there's something peculiarly precious in this passage. There are, without question, mysteries here. The appearance of Moses and Elijah in recognizable bodily form. The cloud enveloping, forming around the disciples. The transformation of Christ's appearance. The voice of Almighty God, audible. And then the sudden disappearance of Moses, Elijah, the cloud, and the return to normality. So I'd like to set the scene a little bit this morning and look at this passage and then focus our thoughts on the words spoken by the Lord out of the cloud. This is my beloved Son. Hear him. So let's set the scene a little. Firstly, Jesus is setting his face to go to Jerusalem. The time of his sufferings is drawing near. It will not be very long before he enters Jerusalem for the last time. And he takes with him Peter, James and John. And as his custom was, he journeys out of the bustle of the villages, away from everybody else, and he travels to a high mountain. That in itself was not unusual. That was his common practice. Often the Lord would leave the people and his own disciples to go to deserted places to pray, usually very early in the morning or late at night. And you may be aware that on occasions Jesus singled out these three disciples, James and Peter and John. And these three witnessed things that others did not see. So Jesus took Peter, James and John with him when he raised Jairus' little daughter from the dead. And you may recall these same three were present, his closest disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane shortly before he was arrested. So in God's purposes, these three, Peter, James and John, saw things that others were not permitted to see. And that in itself, of course, is of interest. And perhaps you can conjecture why. But perhaps it's simplest just to say that God deals individually with his people and designs in his providence different experiences for one or another according to his purposes. He's on the throne. But of course, Peter, James and John were to become great leaders in the church. So perhaps there's something significant in that. But it's also significant that there were three. The number three is significant. And it's a matter of the law. It's a legal matter. It's simply a matter of evidence. Two or three witnesses were required in Jewish law to substantiate an event. And here Jesus takes three disciples. As this event is so remarkable, so miraculous, so unbelievable to our normal human mind, you can see the wisdom of God in ensuring that there were three present to witness these things. And so the small group begin their journey up the mountain. Now, you might be interested that Bible scholars have tried to identify the mountain, and you can probably go on a tour to the Mount of Transfiguration in Israel to this day. Well, it's difficult to determine. It's difficult to know for sure. We know that it's a high mountain mentioned by Matthew and Mark. Luke calls it the mountain, as if it was well known to the disciples. Mount Hermon, Mount Tabor, Mount Meron are all possibilities. But it is, of course, conjecture. Perhaps Mount Hermon has the most advocates as it's closest to where Jesus was teaching just a week or so before. But most likely, though, it's night. That, we think, is most likely, as Luke tells us, that the disciples were quite overcome by tiredness and sleep. They couldn't stay awake. So Peter, James, and John make their way with Jesus and ascend this dark, cold, bleak, and barren place. And it's still and it's silent. And there would have been a majestic beauty in the climb, wouldn't there? The sun was setting, shadows spreading across the mountain, the distant views disappearing with the day. And those of you who enjoy walking in the mountains will perhaps be able to comprehend something of the beauty and the stillness and the quietness of the scene. And it's in this place, this dark and isolated place, we're told that Jesus' appearance is changed, transformed, the word can be translated. You will be familiar perhaps with that word in Romans chapter 12 verse 2, we're exhorted to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. It's the same word, transformed. The word metamorphosis also is derived from this word. It's not a change in his body, but a change in his appearance. Luke says his face was changed in appearance. Matthew says it shone as the sun. Mark says that his garments became radiant and exceedingly white like snow, as no launderer on earth could whiten them. So here's an ancient launderer, a washing of clothes. I don't feel particularly qualified to talk much about washing clothes. But here's an ancient launderer, and he's bleaching and whitening a garment. Brilliant whiteness. So on this mountain, Peter, James, and John witness a brightness and intensity which words can scarcely describe. What a scene. What an extraordinary scene for Peter, James, and John to watch. And yet, it's not finished. In the midst of this scene, Moses and Elijah appear and speak to Jesus. And we know from Luke's account the subject of their conversation. Luke tells us they appeared in glory and spoke of Jesus' decease or departure, or as the word literally means, his exodus, which he was shortly accomplish at Jerusalem. So you have the great lawgiver Moses, Elijah, the last of the great prophets, speaking to Jesus about what he is to come. And understandably, the disciples are terrified. And Peter doesn't know what to say, but he says something. And we empathize with him in his stumbling. He asked to make three booths or tents or tabernacles. Perhaps his idea is that then people can come up the mountain and visit one and then the other and then the other and see this remarkable scene that God has revealed to them. But his theology is falls short. You see, the Moses, the great lawgiver, but there's a greater than Moses there. Elijah, the great prophet, but there's a greater than Elijah present there. And then a great cloud envelops them. It overshadows them. It covers them. And a voice comes out of the cloud. This is my beloved son. Hear him. Or Matthew says, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. Or if you prefer, as some modern translators render it, this is my dearly loved son, hear him. And then normality. Then stillness. The voice of God, the voice of Almighty God. And then all is quiet and all is still. God's presence, manifestations of his glory, and then normality. Then back to the bleakness and coldness of the mountain. And when you consider and think about this account and what happened, it's hardly surprising that Peter, James and John always remembered this event. Although John, in his gospel, doesn't explicitly tell us about the transfiguration, he does surely refer to it in the very first chapter where he says, "We beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." We saw his glory, he tells us. We beheld it. He must surely have this in mind. And as we read earlier, Peter never forgot. He says, "We were eyewitnesses of his majesty, for he received from God the Father honor and glory when such a voice came to him from the excellent glory. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And we, Peter says, we heard this voice which came from heaven when we're with him on the Holy Mount. Well, they never forgot this day. And as we've set the scene this morning, how too we should pray, shouldn't we? To have a meeting with our God today, which we never, ever forget. A time in God's presence, memorable to our souls, which we can muse and reflect upon and think upon when the way is hard and the way is difficult, when the mountain is bleak and dark and cold. How in our day, today, we need a veil removed and to see something of God's glory revealed, to see and understand things in a way we've never seen them and understood them before, when the spiritual slumber is wiped from our eyes and we see something of his glory. That should be our prayer today. So we set the scene a little bit, and in the time that remains, I'd like to focus on the words that God the Father spoke on the mountain. "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." And you may recall these words came from heaven on the occasion of Jesus' baptism. At the beginning of Jesus' ministry, these words are spoken. And just as he's about to enter upon his sufferings, the same words are spoken again. God the Father repeats these words. Now, three times in the Gospels, we're told that God the Father spoke audibly from heaven. Jesus' baptism, here at the Transfiguration, and also in John chapter 12, where Jesus is praying and he cries out, "Father, glorify your name." And we're told by John then a voice came from heaven saying, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." And those who were present heard the voice, but some said it had thundered, and others said an angel had spoken to him. What a thing it is to hear the voice of God. It is something in the scriptures that is both rare and remarkable, this audible voice of God. Sometimes it's thunder. Sometimes it's like the sound of many waters. Sometimes it's like a trumpet. Sometimes it's like the sound of an army, a great voice. But sometimes it's a still, small voice. "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." Beloved means much loved, a special, a particular love. "This is the Son whom I love," declares God. How God the Father loves God the Son with an intimacy and an intensity which is beyond human words. How can we enter in here? Here the water is very deep. Like Moses, we need to take the sandals off our feet. This is holy ground. And though we may not be able to comprehend the depths, let us at least try to search a little. And we may not plunge fully in, but let us at least try to dip our feet. The Father loves the Son in his person. And the Father loves the Son in his work. So the Father loves the Son in his person. Before the creation of the world, he loved him. In the glory that he had with him, before the world began, he loved him. Before time, as we know it, the Father loved the Son. Communion and fellowship that we cannot comprehend, with a unity and a glory beyond our understanding. When Jesus took on human flesh, he loved him in his person. When that divine nature was intertwined, joined, and fused with human nature, when God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man, he loved him. When thrones for a manger, he did surrender. When sapphire paved courts were exchanged for stable floor, he loved him. When he saw him in the feeding trough, lo, within a manger lies he who built the starry skies. When he saw him lay aside his glory, born for us a child of earth. When all the angels sang for him, and the bells of heaven rang for him. It's no wonder the hymn writers struggle to find words to describe it. He loved him in his person. Welcome to earth, thou noble guest, through whom this sinful world is blessed. And the words we know so well, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity, pleased as man with man to dwell. Jesus, our Emmanuel. He loved him when he came to earth, when he became what he had not been and took upon him human flesh. He loved him, my beloved son, when he grew up as a boy and subjected himself to the care and to the direction of earthly parents, when he watched him learning to form words in his humanity, learning to walk, to run, to understand, to comprehend, to interpret Hebrew symbols and forms, when the one who built the starry skies created, molded, cut, made from wood, shapes in the carpenter's shop, he loved him. When he communed with him on the mountain, he loved him. When all the earth was still, and Jesus alone prayed to his Father, he loved him. When he saw him walk this earth and heal the sick and feed the hungry and teach the people, he loved him. When he spoke words which were without guile or craft, words of truth, words of compassion, he loved him. When he saw him weep for the multitudes, he saw him grieve at the tomb, sorrow at the sight of Jerusalem's walls, he loved him. When he saw him grieve at the proud and hard-hearted, when he spoke to warn and to rebuke and to challenge and to wake men and women out of their spiritual slumber, he loved him. This is my beloved son. The Father loved the Son in his person. But the Father also loves the Son in his work. And here is the center of our faith. Why did the Father send the Son? And why did the Son willingly come? Willingly come. Why? What did Jesus mean when he said, I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you've given me to do. Ponder for a minute. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. So the Father loves the Son in his work to be the just one, the righteous one, the perfect one, to know no sin, to be our righteousness, to live the life that you and I can never live, to be that perfect man, to perfectly fulfill the law, to be the second Adam who to the fight and to the rescue came. Day by day, hour by hour, he perfectly fulfilled the law of God for us, without sin or moral impurity or moral stain. God loved him in as the just one. When he looked into his heart and all was purity and holiness and all was love and mercy and grace and truth, he loved him. When there was one alone who was righteous, one alone who was tempted in all points as we are, as yet without sin, he loved him. So he loved him in his work as the sinless perfect one. But the Father also loves the Son in his work to be sin for us, in his work to be punished in our place. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He made him who knew no sin to be sin for us. The Holy One became sin. He loved him in his work to be punished in our place. He loved him for laying down his life, for willingly giving up his life, for enduring the cross. He loves him for being the willing sacrifice. He loves him though he struck him. He loves him though he put him to grief. Though he was angry with him for our sakes. Though he poured out his anger and punished him in our place. This is his beloved Son. Though he left him desolate and forsaken, though the sight of the righteous one becoming sin was abhorrent in his sight, though my sins held him there, though he drank the cup alone, he loves him. And the Father loved the Son for his work to be the just one. And he loves the Son for giving up his life for us. But he loves the Son for taking up his life again. As Jesus says, therefore, the Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. He loved him when death could not hold him, when the stone was rolled away, when he tore the bars away, when death was swallowed up in victory. He loved him when the angel said, why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here. The powers of death have done their worst, but Christ, their legion, hath dispersed. And he loved him when he said, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God. When on the Mount of Olives another cloud enveloped him and he was taken from their sight. He loved him when he sat down at his right hand in the place of glory and honour and praise, when the everlasting gates were opened and the King came in, when the head that once was crowned with thorns as crowned with glory now, when the royal diadem adorned the mighty victor's brow, when the highest place that heaven affords was his by sovereign right. This is my beloved son, the Father says, hear him. So the Father loves the Son in his person, and he loves the Son in his work. But have you ever really thought, what is the real miracle on this Mount of Transfiguration that so astonished Peter, James and John? What is the miracle? What is so miraculous? What is so amazing? And it's not that Jesus' appearance was changed. It's not that he was transformed. It's not that the glory and the majesty of who he really was demonstrated. That wasn't the miracle. The miracle was not his face shining like snow or as a blazing light. The miracle was not even the hearing of the voice of God the Father. The miracle was rather this, that for a moment, the veil was lifted. The corner of the curtain was pulled aside, and Jesus' true glory was seen and shown to these three men. The miracle was that these three were given a glimpse of Jesus' true glory, like the small child peeking through the crowd to see the royal procession, like the lifting of the corner of the treasure box. The real miracle of the story we've been looking at this morning was that his being didn't shine with his brightness of his glory all his days. That the wonder of God manifest in the flesh didn't shine through his body wherever he went. The miracle was that his true glory was hidden. That truly he was veiled in flesh. He was wrapped in clay. The miracle was surely that the stones didn't continually chant his praise, and the trees of the field clapped their hands, and the mountains and the hills burst forth into singing wherever he went. That's the miracle, that his glory was veiled. And here for a moment, Peter, James and John sees him as he really is. So how should we respond this morning to the transfiguration? How can we respond to these things? How can we respond to this voice? This is my beloved son. Hear him. Two very brief thoughts. If this God be for us, if this God be for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? If this God is for us, who can be against us? And secondly, hear him. Hear him. No one ever spoke like this man. This is our God, the servant king. He calls us now to follow him. Hear his voice. Come to me, he says, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in spirit, and you will find rest for your souls. My son, give me your heart. My daughter, give me your heart. We have his words, this sure word of prophecy, this book, which we do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place. It's his words we need in this coming week. Hear him. This is my beloved son. Hear him. Above the voices of the world around me, my hopes and dreams, my cares and loves and fears, the long-awaited call of Christ has found me. The voice of Jesus echoes in my ears. I gave my life to break the cords that bind you. I rose from death to set your spirit free. Turn from your sins and put your past behind you. Take up your cross and come and follow me. This is my beloved son. Hear him.